Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual with our Saturday afternoon sports show. And a lot of action today, as you know, in basketball. And there's a lot of pro basketball on the tube tomorrow. So there are plenty of things to listen to and to look at. Our guests today, and we're delighted to have them, are two old friends. One of the great tennis players of all time, Frank Parker, and another very close friend of mine, Ben Bentley, who was associated for many years with the top fighters in the world, very, very close in the fight game, now works for the Park District. And we're looking forward to talking to these two gentlemen, and they'll be with us in just about 1 minute. We're delighted to have Frank Parker with us, who was a great tennis player for many, many years. He came into the tennis picture right after the Tilden era. And you remember, of course, Bill Tilden, one of the greatest players that ever lived. Frank, what do you recall particularly about Tilden? And I know you were close to him and to Billy Johnson.
Well, as a boy, like 13, 14 years old, I played Bill in an exhibition match in Delafield, Wisconsin. And to me, he was the greatest tennis player that ever lived. He did things with the tennis ball that I haven't seen for a long, long time. He was able to spin the ball, drive it past his opponent with tremendous accuracy. And Bill Tilden, Donald Budge, Ellsworth Bynes, Fred Perry, Jack Kramer, Gonzalez are the top six in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
How would you say Tilden was with his service? Could you break it at all?
Tilden had one of the fastest serves at the time. I would think it doesn't compare to the way they clock the ball now. I think it's about 140 miles an hour. But Tilden had a serve that was difficult to handle because he looked in one direction and served the ball in another. So you were constantly off guard.
Frank, is it possible and have the great players, let's say like Tilden and Johnson, those kind of guys, are they as good with their forehand as they are with their backhand?
Most players have one particular shot that they carry throughout the game. With Tilden, it was his serve and his thinking ability. Today, you have a Bjorn Borg who is exceptional in all departments except in the volley game, but he doesn't have to volley because he is strong in the backcourt. And you take a fellow like Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe, their concentration gets off a great deal. And Borg, to me, has the finest concentration in the game today.
What about surfaces? Do they make an awful lot of difference to a great player?
Oh, yes, but a champion is able to come across regardless of the surface. We have grass, which has gradually been eliminated. The only countries that carry grass courts today, Wimbledon and Australia, because the upkeep is tremendous, and the pros play indoors now on surfaces, sport face. They carry it along with them wherever they go. Wood, when I was playing indoors, was the top surface. It's very fast. And the game has come along a great deal in advocation of new tennis rackets from wood to steel. And
what about the ball?
The ball has changed somewhat, but not that drastically as the tennis rackets.
Has the size of the ball changed?
No, it still is the same. The tennis rackets have changed. They have this new Prince racket, which has a lot of the youngsters use it, and a lot of the older people with arm trouble, tennis elbow, they use it. That's the only change in the tennis racket field that has changed a great deal.
I know that in England they're great for horse racing. That's probably their number one sport over there, where ours is baseball. But tennis is still very big there, and Wimbledon is probably the best known court in the world, isn't it?
That's true. Wimbledon is the horse racing and Kentucky Derby and baseball, our World Series. They have daily attendance at Wimbledon, 40,000 people. Can you imagine that? Every day, 40,000 people go through the turnstiles.
Well, is there a town called Wimbledon?
Yes, that's true. Yes, Wimbledon is about 20 minutes outside of London. And they are driven, chauffeur-driven from their hotels. The players are driven to the courts because they used to take the subways before. And at Wimbledon, if you're delayed, if you're not there when your match is announced, you are defaulted. So they bring them by chauffeur-driven cars today. It's changed when I was there in 1937.
I can remember back when you were playing the great universal interest in tennis. For example, France had some great players. England had great players. What's happened to the game?
Well, the game has improved a great deal. The Davis Cup, the United States held the Davis Cup the last 2 years. We were beaten by Argentina just a month ago. The era of you're speaking of in France was Henri Cochet, Brugnon, Lacoste. The Australians came along with Laver and Hoad and Sedgman. The United States had Budge, and we brought back the Davis Cup in 1937 and held it until 1948. There's a trend, but today tennis has improved so much. There are so many good players throughout the world, like Argentina has Vilas, United States has Jimmy Connors and McEnroe, Sweden has Borg. Everyone is a champion in their own right, and it's difficult to decide now certain nations going to hold the cup because it varies a great deal.
The last time I was in London, one of the great players has a shop there. You know who that was?
Drobny?
Yes, I believe.
He has a sports shop in London.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
He was one of these defectors from Czechoslovakia, similar to Martina Navratilova, who is living now in Dallas, Texas, has a home in Palm Springs, and she's one of the greatest women tennis players today.
Now, your work now is mostly as a teacher, right?
I'm the sports director at McClurg Court Sports Center here in Chicago. It's across from the CBS studios, and I never taught in my life before, Bob, and I was in the box business, corrugated containers for 26 years. I retired, and then Jerry Wexler, my friend, says, why don't you take over as sports director at McClurg Court? And I said, gladly, and I started last September, and I love it.
Yeah, well, I should say so. That's a great spot. Well, tennis has been a really, really marvelous game. You say Tilden was the greatest player of all time?
In my mind, in my estimation, yes. Uh-huh.
How good? I know you don't rate him with Tilden, but how good was Bobby Riggs?
Riggs, well, you can't take away the fact that he won Wimbledon twice, United States Championship twice. People forget that he was the top player at his time. And today, people know him as a buffoon. He kids around a great deal.
We had him on our show here, and he kidded around.
Yes, he's a, as you know, you're buddies with him, so am I. I've known him for 30 years. We played Davis Cup together. A fine fella, but he went this route where he's making money, doing commercials and acting the buffoon.
Frank, what part does size, height play in tennis?
In the Tilden era, he was the 6'2". Today, size doesn't mean that much. Bobby Riggs, for instance, was 5'8.5" at most. I'm 5'10". Rosewall is 5'8". If you're tall, it's fine. You can reach the ball, but it's difficult to get down to the low ones.
For a short time there, I remember the Japanese had some outstanding players, but there's a case you very seldom see a tall Japanese.
That's right. You never see them even outside of sports. They're small of stature. I remember playing my first Davis Cup match against the Japan in San Francisco, and they weren't more than 5'7", 5'6", but they were very fast, very quick, could handle a racket real well.
Well, now your work today, you're through playing, but you do play... Keep in shape.
Yeah, I'll play in the Alan King Classic in Las Vegas, and I do some clinics for Eastman Kodal, and play exhibitions and give clinics.
Mm-hmm. Well, that keeps you busy, and you look in great shape.
Thank you kindly, and I love it. Mm-hmm.
Frank, it's been a pleasure having you as our guest here today, and lots of continued success and good health with you.
Thank you very much, Bob, and a happy birthday to
you.
Thank
you. Our guest, one of the great players of all time, Frank Parker, and tennis players, that's a name that really comes to the forefront immediately. Our other guest today, another old friend of mine, we're going to talk about the fight game and things like that with Ben Bentley, and Ben will be our guest in just about 1 minute. Frank, before I get to Ben Bentley, you forgot to mention the Chicagoland Tennis Association.
Yes, they're a group formed here in Chicago. 50 of the top members belong to this association, and it promotes indoor tennis, and they have all the amenities and the facilities here for youngsters, for clinics and whatnot.
That's great. We're delighted to have my old friend Ben Bentley here with us. We've been pretty close together for about 40 or 50 years, I guess. Right, Ben?
A long time, Bob.
A long, long time, and it's always so nice to see you. I've always, in the back of, even though my life has been so wrapped up with baseball, I've always enjoyed the fight game. And perhaps through my friendship with Ben Bentley, I got to know some of the all-time great fighters. And you can remember, I know, some of these fellows that were here in Chicago and fights over in Detroit.
Yes, we talked about the fighters that we both knew, meeting you in Detroit when I was up there for the Jake LaMotta-Irish Bob Murphy fight, and meeting you in the hotel. I was staying in the same hotel, and you asked me to come out to the Briggs Stadium at that time, and you were sitting in a press box that looked like a dungeon. And when I met you, you said the first thing, please, go out and get me coffee and get me a hot dog. I'm starving in here, and I have no communication. And I went out and got you the hot dog, and I got you the coffee. And, of course, you plugged the fight, which was Jake LaMotta and Irish Bob Murphy, one of the truly great fights I've ever seen.
We all know that every sport is in the forefront in certain eras. But what has actually happened to the fight game? How alive is it today?
Well, it's alive today. The networks are very, very selective and competitive in staging fights. Now, every Saturday and Sunday on one of the networks, you will see a fight. The only difference is that the average public, the average fight fan, has a tough time identifying with a particular fight or a fighter. It wasn't so during the days of the late and great, may Lord rest his soul, James D. Norris, when he was running the International Boxing Club, and we brought in something like 22 or 23 world title fights in Chicago. You had the Marcianos box here, you had the Sugar Ray Robinsons box here, you had Jake LaMotta boxing here, you had Willie Pep. It was a complete different era. It was something that the average fight fan could tell you every fighter in each respective weight, from the bantamweight all the way up to the heavyweight division. Today, right in this bank, right now, you ask any one of these people, take a $10 bill in your hand, ask him who the featherweight champion or the bantamweight champion is, and you'll put the money right back in your pocket. They don't know. And that's how the era has changed. The only one in the business today, the active fighter today, that has attracted the boxing public to a great extent to Sugar Ray Leonard. And they're all waiting for Sugar Ray Leonard to fight one Roberto Duran. And when that fight comes along, it'll be another thriller in Manila. It'll have that kind of emotion and excitement. But as far as they're all good fighters, but nobody can identify with them, Bob.
You can remember, and I can remember, those Zale Hostak fights at the stadium.
There's a very interesting story about that Hostak fight. His manager came through Chicago, Nate Ruxler, and he walked up to the late Sam Payan, who had Tony Zale here in Chicago. He said, "Sam, I'm on my way for the Christmas show in Cleveland, Ohio, for Larry Atkins. On my way back to Seattle," he said, "I'd like to fight in Chicago. Who you got?" He said, "And we'll put a fight on." Sam said they were drafting Jim on 180 West Randolph in those days. He says, in a few minutes, I got a middleweight named Tony Zale. He'll be working out. Well, whether you know it or not, Tony Zale was a notoriously poor gym fighter. He was awful in the gym. So Zale gets in the ring, and he begins working out, and Drexler turns around to Sam Payan. He said, are you kidding? He said, you mean to tell me the commission would pass this fight? And Payan said, yes. He says, the commission will pass this fight. He said, this guy's horrible. And I don't have to tell you what happened. Al Hostak got into the ring with Tony Zale. Zale stopped him here in Chicago. Now they went on to Seattle. Nate Drexler said, hey, I got to get this title back from this guy. You tricked me. This is a pretty good fighter. And so they went back to Seattle. And, of course, he won again in Seattle over Al Hostak. But those were two great wars. And nobody really know how that fight was made until today.
That's right. You know, the late Jack Kearns, you know Jack as well as I did. We used to have breakfast in Henrici's three or four times a week. And all he'd ever want to talk about was the fight game. Well, I was a fight fan, so I enjoyed that. And I said to him one day, who was the greatest heavyweight fighter that you ever saw? Who would you say was the greatest heavyweight of all time? Do you know who he said?
No.
Jack Johnson.
I was going to say he probably said Jack Johnson because at that time he was at odds with, to me, one of the great fighters of all time that he managed, Jack Dempsey. And you talk about Kearns. To me, Kearns started me out in boxing, you know. Kearns was the first one to take me out on the road when Maxim fought Archie Moore for the championship in St. Louis. He went to the late Jim Norris and said, I want this kid Bentley to go along with me. Reminds me of the old gang that I had around me, and he was undoubtedly one of the shrewdest managers that I had ever met. He was 2 miles ahead of you, and he did things. The newspaper people just loved this man, and it was just too bad that he and Dempsey had this break. And actually, they first said hello to each other. You know your friend Harry Carey? He had a show in St. Louis. And we were there for the Maxim fight, of which Jack Kearns had a piece of Maxim. And prior to going on the air, Jack Dempsey was being interviewed by Harry Carey. I was told by newspaper people, watch out for this Harry Carey. He's a hatchet man. He'll knock your brains out. But anyway, we went on the air, and as we got off the air, both Dempsey and Kearns met each other in the hall, and Kearns, who was known as Doc, Dempsey said to him, how you doing, Doc? And Kearns answered, how you doing, Jack? And we both went down the elevator, and they never talked after that.
Is that right?
Yeah, led them to a title. They split God knows how many millions of dollars together. You know, when Jack Kearns had a dollar in his pocket, nobody starved. And Jack Kearns, when he would throw a party, the party would start on a Monday and would end on Good Friday. And he used to rent the cottage at the old Morrison Hotel and have the whole fight crowd up there. I remember walking down the street with Jack Kearns in San Francisco. And he said to me, again, he had Maxim in with Bobo Olsen. And he said to me, it's a little damp and cold here in San Francisco. I don't like that coat you're wearing. And he took me into a very, very fancy store. And in those days, he bought me one of those raincoats that run about $100, $150, which today, what are you talking about, $300, $400, you know. And when he left, he was passing money out like it was going out of style. I knew he didn't have money with him, and we were waiting outside Sid Flaherty's office, who had Bobo Olsen. And I said, Doc, look, I got a few hundred on me. Why don't you take it? And when you get to Chicago, it'll settle. He said, you got nothing to worry about, kid. I'm going in to see that big farmer in there. He's got Bobo Olsen. He says, I'll rob him pretty good. And he walked out there. He had Sid Flaherty believing that Bobo Olsen was going to fight Marciano for the title. And I don't know how many thousands he got off of him, but he was in pretty good shape.
Ben Bentley, what do you remember, or what have you heard, or what is the inside story of the famous long count?
Well, I was not there. I was just a youngster. I was not there. The true story, the story that I got from Kearns, from people who attended, was Jack Dempsey was a very emotional fighter, extremely emotional. I could go on and tell you stories about him, how emotional he was. But they had something like 110,000 people there, and when he knocked Tunney down, the crowd began to roar. The late Dave Berry, who was referee, had told both fighters when they came to the center of the ring that in case of a knockdown, the fighter goes to the farthest neutral corner, the fighter who scores the knockdown. When Dempsey knocked Tunney down, he stood over him. He got so emotional that he stood over him, and Berry kept warning him to go back to the neutral corner. And by that time, by the time he went down to the neutral corner, by the time Dave Berry began his count, there must have been 2, 3, or 4 minutes elapsed, which gave Tunney enough time to get to his feet, and eventually he outpointed Jack Dempsey. That, Bob, is the honest-to-God story. There's been all sorts of stories, but that was the story.
Well, that's a great story. What about the people in the fight game and the great people in the game that you knew? How good a fighter was Tunney? I know he was a socialite. His wife is a very famous social figure in the East and so on and so forth. How good a fighter was he?
Tunney was very astute. Tunney was never what you call a great crowd pleaser. You know, he was not the kind of a fighter like Dempsey or Marciano or Joe Louis, whom you know that if they threw one punch, they were going to take you out and the crowd anticipated. He was a very astute student of boxing, a great boxer, and he knew how to handle the grabs. He knew how to handle Dempsey, and of course, without any excuses, without demeaning Tunney, when he caught Dempsey the second time, he caught an old man, remember that, and still got knocked down. But he was a great student of boxing. He could outbox you, outsmart you, and he anticipated what you were going to do next. And that's a great talent for any fighter in the ring who anticipates that the kind of a punch that you're going to throw or what your next move is going to be, and that's what he did with Jack Dempsey. And that's the kind of a fighter he was. That was his style.
You were too young to, as you say, you never saw Jack Johnson, but he was in a great fight with Jess Willard, I believe, at Toledo.
No, Toledo was Jack Dempsey. No, this was in Nevada.
Nevada.
In Nevada, yeah, they fought in Nevada. And that was the one where I remember correctly, Johnson got knocked down and laid down and put the gloves over his eyes because the sun was shining so brightly. And they counted 10, and he got up and he said, "Where's the showers?"
What about a friend who's a friend of yours and a friend of mine, the late wonderful Barney Ross?
Well, Barney was undoubtedly one of the classiest, gutsiest fighters Chicago ever really produced. Barney Ross, his fight here with Tony Canzoneri was a classic. When he won the lightweight championship here in Chicago, they went back to New York City in a 15-rounder. He went back, he won again. But one of the most interesting stories about Barney Ross is the McLaren fight. He begged his manager that he wanted Jimmy McLaren. Have we got enough time, Bob? Okay. He wanted Jimmy McLaren very badly because Jimmy McLaren had the reputation for knocking out all the Jewish fighters. He knocked out Benny Leonard. He knocked out Al Singer. He knocked out, maybe a half a dozen of them. And Barney Ross wanted to prove that this was one Jewish fighter he wasn't going to knock out. His manager said to him, "Look, you're the lightweight champion of the world. McLaren is at his, we don't need no Jimmy McLaren. We don't need the welterweight champ." He says, "Now, if you don't make the fight, I'll go to New York and I'll make the fight with Mike Jacobs." Well, anyhow, they all got on a train. They made the fight and, McLaren, lost the fight to Barney Ross. The second fight, McLaren won. And in the third fight, Ross, beat him again. But the classic fight, of course, was when he lost to Henry Armstrong. And they wanted to stop the fight, and he turned around to his manager, and he said, "If you ever stop the fight, as long as you live, I will never talk to you." And he got pounded for 8 straight rounds by Henry Armstrong, who kept turning around to the referee, saying, "Don't you think he's had enough?" And Barney would holler, "I'm still tough. Keep coming at me. Keep coming at me." So Barney was one of the greatest. We're talking about a great
fighter.
That's
a wonderful story. Our guest right now is Ben Bentley, an old friend and a familiar figure around fighters and all the great fighters. We'll be back with our guest in just about 1 minute. We've been talking today with Frank Parker, a former great tennis player, and Ben Bentley, and in one particular phase of both of your interests, the business of footwork, it's very important, right, Frank?
In tennis, it's most important because you have to get set for the stroke, and then you deliver the punch. Same thing in boxing. You dance around till you're set, and then you throw the punch. I am sure Ben will agree with me.
I do. The first thing that a fighter loses when he gets a little older is his footwork. And footwork is very, very important to a fighter. And the feet lead you into scoring positions. So there is a definite relationship between tennis and boxing as far as footwork.
Ben Bentley, one last question. Who was the greatest fighter you ever saw?
Without a doubt, Rocky Marciano.
Well, he was something. I agree with you. Rocky Marciano, one of the all-time great fighters. We've enjoyed ever so much having Frank Parker with us, great tennis player, and Ben Bentley, a great sports enthusiast, and perhaps closer to the big names in fighting than anybody in the country. So we've enjoyed them both. We hope that you have too. And now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next week at our usual time.